The court will now call Ezekiel Cox versus the state of Texas. May it please the court. Mr. Jason Edward Niehaus will argue for the appellant. Ms. Laura Tomlin will argue for the state.
May it please the court. Counsel, Jason Niehaus on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Ezekiel Cox. Mr. Ezekiel Cox was convicted of capital murder. The state did not seek the death penalty. His sentence was an automatic determinate life without parole. In four issues, I contend that the evidence was not legally sufficient to support the verdict of capital murder, that the court erred in deviating from the statutory jury oath contained in Article 3522 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, that the court erred by admitting autopsy photos, and the defendant has a due process right to make a statement and allocution prior to the court assessing determinate sentence.
Do you think that, that there's a right to allocution when the punishment is automatically life in prison?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
How would that have made any difference?
Yes, Your Honor, it's relevant to possibly future habeas proceedings, and the defendant has an unequivocal right to be heard in a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. By assessing sentence automatically without the defendant having the opportunity to be heard with regard to punishment, even if it doesn't make a difference, the defendant is entitled to be heard. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, I make a arguably technical point on the jury's ability to draw an inference from the testimony versus the jury's engaging in speculation from the testimony. The jury is allowed to make an inference. The jury is not allowed to speculate. My contention is that Detective Ahern, who testifies in the fifth volume of the record, offers a theory to the jury that on the basis of the commission of both a homicide and a robbery or a burglary, that defendant must have intended to commit the two at the same time. There's no other evidence in the record to appellant's mental state at the time that he was invited into the decedent's home.
What about the testimony regarding his pattern of stealing prior or committing theft prior to the incident that we're here today about, the fact that I can't remember the terminology that I learned from this case, but it was...
That he was going to hit a lick?
Hit a lick. Yes.
The Court of Criminal Appeals in Winfrey versus State has stated that appellant's expression of knowledge that the decedent had money in his home and that he went to the house because it was an easy lick does not reveal any intent at the time the homicide was committed for appellant to have committed the homicide. Essentially, you need concurrent mens rea. You have to have the intent to commit the robbery or burglary at the exact same time as you need the intent to commit the murder. If appellant developed the intent to rob before the intent to murder, or if he developed the intent to rob after he developed the intent to murder the victim in this case, you don't have mens rea necessary for capital murder. You have mens rea necessary for both offenses individually, and he can be punished for both offenses individually, but you do not have mens rea necessary for a capital murder.
So you say that we're not inferring intent in that situation, but we're speculating as to intent.
Correct. The detective offered a theory to the jury, and the Court of Criminal Appeals has specifically placed theorizing in the realm of speculation in Hooper v. State from 2007. Mere theorizing is a form of speculation from which the jury cannot find beyond a reasonable doubt that defendant had the correct mens rea to commit a capital murder.
So what kind of evidence in other cases has been found sufficient that there was an intent developed to rob first?
Usually you need a combination of imminent time frame, i.e. that the murder and the robbery occur instantaneously. In this case, you've got appellant made contact originally with the victim between 7:30 and 8 o'clock in the morning and is not seen leaving the apartment until almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You have a full almost 8 hours during which the appellant was in and out of the apartment, at some point during that 8 hours, the victim died. At some point during that 8 hours, defendant committed the robbery. We don't know if those two overlap at all. Further corroborating defendant's story, which is admittedly out there, trial counsel argued that the truth is stranger than fiction, and there is frankly no better way for us to put it than this case. Decedent was a Wiccan who, when defendant made contact with her, was watching the TV show Charmed. Defendant's version of events is this happens at between 7:30 and 8 o'clock in the morning, which is consistent with TNT's syndicated TV schedule, during which Charmed airs from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. Appellant also discusses how he smoked marijuana with the decedent while they were conversing about her life. This is further corroborated by the marijuana blunt that's found in the ashtray in decedent's apartment and the marijuana found in the decedent's system during the autopsy, further establishing that defendant did not, at the time that he entered the apartment, have the intent to either rob her or kill her, is the absence of forced entry. The lock is not forced, there is no damage to the door. Now, granted, at some point, appellant did form the intent to kill the decedent.
Didn't he say that that was because she wanted his blood?
Yes.
For some satanic ritual or something?
That's correct, Your Honor, and this is where we get to the truth is stranger than fiction piece, is apparently during the TV show while they were watching Charm together and consuming marijuana, the decedent, according to the appellant, states that she requires his blood for a sacrifice to Satan, and she came at him with a knife. Defendant disarms the decedent, puts her in a chokehold, and during the chokehold is when appellant asserts that the decedent passed. Appellant then goes on to create a problem for himself by slashing the decedent's throat, attempting to hang her, and dragging her to the bathroom, where he then finishes strangling her. There is no meritorious argument that he did not intend to kill the decedent. That much is clear from his action. The only question is at what time that intent developed. Our position is that the admission of the autopsy photos in conjunction with the detective's speculation is what got the jury to capital murder. Is you have two autopsy photos, which were State's Exhibit 190 and 191, that show the defense counsel's word for it was face peel. It's where the medical examiner draws the scalpel across the forehead and peels the face off of the decedent so that the jury may see the underlying skull and portions of the autopsy.
Well, didn't the state argue that was not unduly prejudicial because it could show the jury the extent of her injuries that weren't necessarily visible from the exterior?
If there were fractures that had been visible that way, I would be inclined to agree with the state. But the absence of any fracture or any bleeding that would not be otherwise visible.
So it's your position that all the congealed blood that was shown in the reflected autopsy picture was just as visible?
Correct, yes. There would have been significant bruising. Dr. Pirwani, the medical examiner, refers to it as the raccoon eyes. There was significant bruising of the decedent's face that was all visible without the degloving. Yes. Now, with regard to the deviation from the statutory jury oath,
I want to ask you about that because you're two members of this panel are former trial judges, and I'm sure in my time as a trial judge, I didn't always read the oath word for word. In fact, I'm positive. In my mind, the standard for deviation from the jury oath, as the state says in its brief, should be substantial and material. Can you point to me in the jury oath that was given and the one that's required by statute and look at both of those and tell me what in the oath that was given do you surmise substantially and materially deviates from what's required by the Code of Criminal Procedure?
With respect, Justice Pittman, I don't believe that substantially deviates is the current standard. Arthur B. State, which is a Texas Supreme Court case, prior to the bifurcation of the Texas Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals, states that any deviation whatsoever is reversible error.
So under that case, it's your contention that if you leave out one word or one sentence, or you change one word, that it's enough to get the entire verdict thrown out?
That's what the precedent states, yes, Your Honor.
So, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So she inserted the words or affirm. And is it your position then that those persons in our community who do not swear but affirm can't serve as jurors because they'll be asked to swear if the oath is not deviated from?
The oath is a question for the legislature, Your Honor. I'm happy to have them revise it, but the legislature has...
I didn't ask how you'd write the law. I'm saying, is it your position that there had there been someone on the jury who, for religious reasons, won't swear an oath but will affirm an oath? They couldn't serve because they couldn't take that oath.
That is the logical conclusion of my argument, Your Honor. That conclusion, however, has been previously rejected in the Sixth Court of Appeals in Mapps versus State. As a side note, I was also counsel for Mr. Mapps. I am intimately familiar with the briefing process from that case, and I would like to think that the Marin typing of the statutory jury oath, because this may very well be a waivable error, it was not objected to. So in the event that it is, my position is one, that it's waivable, not forfeitable, so it'd be Category 2 Marin error, not Category 3 Marin error. However, in the event that the court decides that the deviation from the oath is Category 3 Marin error, then I have a preservation problem and we don't have to get there.
But did the case you're referring to out of the Sixth Court, did they find that inserting and affirm, had it been preserved properly, would that have been reversible error, or did they find that that was an immaterial deviation?
The Sixth Court of Appeals in Mapps refused to rule, found the error was not preserved.
Okay,
essentially,
so they didn't get there.
Correct. Finding, without having the benefit of briefing, that the error in deviating from the oath was Category 3 Marin error. For the foregoing reasons, Your Honor, we respectfully request the court reverse, remand for new trial.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Starting with the sufficiency issue, the evidence was sufficient to find that the appellant had the required intent for the underlying felony of the capital murder. Appellant is arguing that this is all based on Detective Aharon's theory of the case, but it's not just based on Detective Aharon's theory. The evidence shows that Robin was a pacifist, she wasn't aggressive, she wasn't violent in relation to her pagan beliefs, and she wasn't likely to have a man over considering her bad experiences with men and her fearful nature. Appellant, on the other hand, was desperate. He was addicted to drugs. He was committing felonies every day. He talked to his friend Jamie about stealing from people. And most notably, he talked to his friend Bridget about hitting licks. And Bridget described hitting licks originally to officers as hitting people over the head and stealing from them, which is exactly what happened with Robin. And appellant argues about the timeline of finding intent. And when he talked to Bridget about this, he went to jail for robbing Susan in 2014. And on January 24th or January 23rd, he got out of jail for that robbery. And he met Bridget while he was in jail. And he was hanging out with Bridget around the same apartment complex that Robin lived in. That's where Bridget lived. And Bridget testified that while they were at that apartment is when he talked about hitting Licks. So appellant gets out of jail for burglary and then is talking about hitting people on the head and stealing from them within a month of doing those actions to Robin at her same apartment complex.
Was there any evidence to suggest, as I understand it, there were no signs of forced entry, and yet Robin's friends and family testified that she was not the type who would have let a man into her apartment. So what's the idea on how he got in there without forced entry?
What the state argued from the totality of the evidence was that Robin was walking her dog and appellants could have followed her in. But we don't know what the jury found, but to find the verdict they did, they could have inferred that he followed her in and he wasn't invited, or they could have inferred that for some reason he was invited, but the evidence shows that he was committing felonies, he planned to commit robberies, he actually planned to rob a bank after he robbed Susan, and so he could, even if he was invited in, he could have had that intent to commit the robbery and murder her, and even if the jury thought that it was in self-defense, it wouldn't have been a valid self-defense because he was also committing the robbery, and it wasn't reasonable, the amount of force that he did on to Robin. Appellant's story, as counsel noted, is not very believable. It strains logic that he was led into Robin's house at all, that she would hang out with him, that she would want his blood for Satan as part of her pagan beliefs, which she was not violent about. And there's a lot of credibility issues with his testimony. For instance, he was adamant that he only hit her once on both direct and cross-examination. But the evidence shows, and Dr. Perriani testified to, that she was hit multiple times.
Yeah, no. That leads me into the autopsy question just a little bit, because I'm not really clear whether the unreflected autopsy photo did in fact reveal injuries that from which a jury could have concluded that the defendant was lying when he said he only hit her once, or was it really necessary to show the reflected scalp?
Yes, it was. There was the testimony of Dr. Perriani about the injuries, but the state's exhibits 191 and 192 showed the amount, which Dr. Perriani considered an enormous amount of blood that was under the scalp. And that was necessary to show that appellant did not hit her once and how brutal this crime was, because the brutality of the crime goes to the fact that he was not acting in self-defense. And the injuries didn't cause death, and we knew there were other injuries, but it's still relevant in this case because of these specific circumstances of him claiming that it was self-defense. And his credibility was on the line, and the state needed to not only hear the testimony of Dr. Perriani, but also show the visual evidence that was not cumulative or of an insignificant probative value, because visual evidence can be more persuasive than testimony and can be a comparison point for credibility, which is what the state used it for here.
What did the autopsy photos add to your quantum of proof that a photograph of the face not peeled back wouldn't have given you? Because the general rule is gruesome autopsy photographs are not admissible. This is a gruesome photograph. It's an autopsy photograph. And so I'm trying to figure out what is it about in this case that wouldn't fall within the general rule. What did it add that couldn't have been gotten with a less gruesome photograph?
Well, and Santillan and Sheffield out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, they list several factors to consider when you're looking at autopsy photos or crime scene photos. And one thing is the specific circumstances of individual cases. And here we have appellant saying that this was self-defense and the state having to disprove that. And while the other photos did show that she had the raccoon eyes, the state needed to prove that Robin was brutally murdered, that he did hit her multiple times. And the enormous amount of blood under the scalp was able to further prove that to the jury. And Dr. Piriani's testimony was available, but this visual evidence was stronger, and it was highly relevant to the credibility of the defendant, to whether he acted in self-defense, and whether the force he used was reasonable. And the pictures were gruesome. And Shuffield goes through the four factors of whether prejudicial photos should come in, and the state briefs that, goes over that a lot in their brief. But
I think one of the factors is whether the physician performing the autopsy actually caused the mutilation. How can you get around the fact that the face peeling in this case was done by the medical examiner and not by the appellate?
In the cases cited by the state in its brief, the danger of the jury confusing whether the medical examiner or the defendant did the damage shown by the autopsy picture is the danger you get into when you put in these autopsy photos of scalp reflections. But here, it was very clear that Dr. Piriani is the one who did the reflection of the scalp. There was no danger of the jury thinking that the scalp was reflected by the appellant. Dr. Piriani went through how he opened up the scalp, and that he testified to that before even showing the pictures. And it was clear that Dr. Piriani is the one who reflected the scalp, but the congealed blood under the scalp was caused by the defendant. The pictures were gruesome, but they were no more gruesome than the facts of the case itself. What appellant did by bludgeoning Robin, strangling her, trying to hang her over her bathroom door, slitting her throat, stealing her sentimental items, all of that could affect a jury in an emotional way just as much as the autopsy pictures. And the autopsy pictures were brought in as part of the medical examiner and part of the autopsy, where the jury would not think that he caused the skin reflection, but also see the damage that appellant caused that was seen under the skin. Several cases have allowed in the skin reflection, including Drew, Harris, Richard, Velez, that are in the state's brief. Most notably is In Re JBC, and that's a 2007 published case out of this court. In that case, the defensive theory was that there was a suicide, and the medical examiner found hemorrhaging under the scalp, like in this case. And those autopsy photographs were admissible, and the court found that the reflection was not significantly more gruesome than the acts by the appellant.
In that case, was there bruising evidence too?
I don't remember if there's bruising evidence or not. I'm sorry. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing in the autopsy photographs, and even if they did, any error was harmless because of the overwhelming evidence against appellant. And these pictures were also not emphasized by the state. They were shown once, and they were brought up once in closing argument, but they were not shown again.
Take me to the issue on the jury oath.
The jury oath issue was not preserved. Mere irregularities in the jury oath or the procedure of seating the jury must be preserved for review. But even if this court were to look at the issue, but not beyond the preservation problem, the oath given by the trial court was substantially similar to 35.22. Appellant cites Arthur, and in his brief, he cites many cases from the 1800s that are a very strict standard. But the standard is, if no oath is given, or if a completely different oath is given, there's reversible error. But where nothing was admitted, and the oath was substantially the same, there's no error. And that was found in Batty v. State, that's a Court of Criminal Appeals case from 1997, and Williams v. State, a Dallas case, it's unpublished, from 2000, where the appellant in that case also relied on the case law from the 1800s, and the court found that if it's substantially similar, there's no error. And regardless, in this case, any error was harmless. Appellant is not arguing that there was jury misconduct. He's not arguing that any jurors were improperly seated onto the jury. And the jury swore and affirmed to render a true verdict according to the evidence. Appellant also did not preserve his allocution issue. Appellant argues that allocution is a fundamental constitutional right, but no court in Texas has found that. And actually, the 13th Court of Appeals in a 2014 unpublished opinion, Sanchez v. State, has found that allocution is not a fundamental right. If appellant is challenged the constitutionality of 4207, that is also not preserved, because a facial or as applied challenge to the constitutionality of a statute must be preserved under Carnev v. State out of the Court of Criminal Appeals from 2009. Appellant was given the opportunity for statutory allocution under 4207, and appellant is asking this court to be the first court to find that there is a fundamental constitutional right to allocution. And in this case specifically, any error, even if this court were to find the fundamental right, is harmless, because the error of not having allocution came after the jury found appellant guilty. So the conviction would not have been different. And because this is a non-death capital case, the sentence of life in prison without parole is automatic. So the punishment would also not be different if appellant was given more allocution. Appellant argues that this is needed for habeas reasons, but in a habeas proceeding, an appellant can get affidavits, depositions, and also in this case, appellant testified for 229 pages with all sorts of mitigating evidence. Appellant argues in his brief that the remedy under the allocution issue would be reversal, but the cases he cites from other jurisdictions, the remedy is resentencing. So even if this court were to find allocution and that there's harm in this case, this court would remand this case to the trial court for appellant to give allocution and they'd be resentenced to life in prison without parole. The state prays that this court will affirm the conviction and judgment of the lower court. Thank you.
Just briefly, Your Honors, with regard to the issue on allocution, appellant would contend that preservation is unnecessary under the rights not recognized doctrine. There are 5 states that have recognized a constitutional right to make a statement in allocution. The D.C. Court of Appeals in the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals have also held there's a constitutional right to make a statement in allocution. Now the fundamental question becomes, does it make a difference? And the state's right, I do have a problem there. Defendant is entitled to be heard. Whether the entitlement to be heard rises to a level where the current iteration of 4207 is unconstitutional, the question for this court. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, the jury's speculation, the detective's speculation, the conflict in the evidence can raise a strong suspicion of guilt. In fact, I go so far as to concede in this case it does raise a strong suspicion of guilt. But if the jury is speculating is impermissive and is insufficient to maintain a verdict beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, but counsel, since the defendant did testify here, wasn't the jury free to disbelieve every word out of his mouth when it came to his saying that he didn't have any intent to rob her until after he had killed her?
The jury is free to disbelieve the appellant, yes, Your Honor.
But you're saying that there has to be, that just that disbelief doesn't rise to the level of sufficiency of evidence to find the contrary? Is that your argument?
Correct. The argument is essentially, Your Honor, nobody believed Michael Morton either. And just because there is a just because the jury is presented with enough so that they could guess at appellant's intent does not give them enough to find beyond a reasonable doubt appellant's intent. It is for that reason we ask the court reverse the trial court, remand for new trial. Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you for coming up today.
And your case has now been submitted. It's my understanding that, well, first of all, I want to thank again the aforementioned persons that allowed us to be here today.